That's what I mean. I don't get enough of that on my diet.
All right, we'll call this hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 14th, 2024. We do have a quorum present. First item on the agenda is the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 12th? Representative Curran.
So moved, Chair.
Representative Curran moves the minutes of March 12th. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Full agenda this week and next. So all the testifiers have been told that they do have a time limit. We'll ask you all to respect that, or I will have to cut you off. First up, kind of weird motion here, but we have House File 3812, which was moved to our committee. So it was sent to House File 3812 as an ACOM bill that was heard in public safety. It was moved to Judiciary, but it doesn't actually have any provisions in it that need to be heard by our committee. Just decided to move things this way. So the motion is going to be that we place this bill in the general register with no recommendation, just an acknowledgement that this isn't actually in the jurisdiction of our committee. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering if I could ask House Research. What I'm not clear on, two things. I remember when the base language, the law that we're amending here, I remember when it came to civil law, I sat on the committee at the time and it came to civil law, this immunity thing, right? And so I just was curious why, I mean, I know we go by chapters of law and whatever, but it was in civil law at that time. I remember it coming to the civil law committee. I do have a question, and that is this immunity just from a criminal charge, or could someone bring a lawful or a wrongful death suit, a civil suit, for a wrongful death in circumstances like this? I don't know if House Research has the answer to that, but before it passes out of this committee, I just wanted to see if there's any clarification on that, if we might, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and I can answer your first comment is I'm a different chair. I draw the lines in a different way. So what previous Judiciary civil law chairs we've had, this committee's been cut up in different ways over the years. So it doesn't really mean anything to me whether a previous chair decided to pull something in or not. Okay, I was going to say, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So on 1.10 of the bill, you see that the immunity, it says that a person may not be charged or prosecuted. So it just deals with immunity from criminal prosecution, not civil liability.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins.
Thank you,
Representative
Chair.
Scott.
That's
it. All right. Any other discussion? Representative Acom, we're not going to get into discussion of the bill since it. I appreciate that you came here at 8:30 in the morning.
I have another hearing at 8:32, so
okay.
I'm happy to go.
Yeah, yes, thank you. You may be excused.
Thank you so much. Appreciate all the help, especially from Ben Johnson. Thank you.
Yep, we all love Ben Johnson. So with that, I will renew my motion to place House File 3812 on the general register without recommendation from this committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Tabke, you have to talk, though. Sorry, not sorry. All right. So I will move House File 4048 in front of the committee with a recommendation that it be placed on the general register. Representative Tabke, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. House File 4048 is the Department of Corrections Omnibus Policy Bill, and today in Judiciary we're talking about three different sections of the bill, 2, 6, and 7, which are sentence adjustment data sharing. It is also clarification of state oversight of local facilities and protection of victim data in parole process. And so, Madam Chair, we have the Commissioner of Department of Corrections, Commissioner Snell, here today to discuss those and enlighten everyone on those provisions.
All right. Commissioner Schnell, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Paul Schnell, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I want to thank you for hearing the department's policy omnibus bill for House File 4048. And I also want to thank Representative Tabke for carrying the bill. For reference, there's a summary of the bill in your materials that lists the provisions in order that they are in the bill. And I'll walk through each of them in order. This bill updates a number of statutes that govern the work of the Department of Corrections, and I'll focus my testimony, as Representative Tapke mentioned, on the portions related to the jurisdiction of this committee. In Section 2, there is a reference to Chapter 13. That language provides fuller clarity with regard to the DOC's authority to access and obtain relevant information from jails and other DOC-licensed facilities in order to fulfill the department's responsibility to perform post-incident inspections following a complaint, a significant incident, or a death in accordance with the law. In 2021, the legislature made the intent of this oversight clear in the passage of the Hardell-Sherrill Act. The act was named after Hardell-Sherrill, a man who died in jail due to a lack of responsive medical care. There has been some questions in some counties about whether they have the legal authority to release relevant information to the Department of Corrections and not violate other provisions of the Minnesota Data Practices Act. This language provides clarity so that the counties are clearly able to provide the information and allow the agency to effectively fulfill its oversight role. Section 6 is an amendment to the statute governing the Supervised Release Board, an entity created last year by the legislature to make parole and supervised release decisions. The work of the board, including meetings with those being considered for parole and those impacted by the crimes, will be open to the public. The Supervised Release Board will be primarily involved in life sentences cases involving homicide or sexual assault. Under the current language, beginning in July, victim meetings with the board would also be public. We know that some victims and families will not want to share their experiences publicly, and we have talked with those who've experienced longstanding mental health impacts as a result of these crimes who would prefer that this information remain private. This provision updates the statute, allowing victims to request that their victim input to the board be closed to the public. The rest of the board hearings will be by default public. And Section 9 is a clarifying change to help prosecutors obtain information they need, such as discipline, adjustment, programming records, acts to assess the appropriateness under the recently enacted prosecutor-initiated resentencing bill passed last year. When prosecutors seek information from the DOC on individuals who are petitioning for resentencing review, the data practice statute compliance is of concern and can delay the process. This language would streamline that process for data sharing with prosecutors' offices for purposes of assessing prosecutor-initiated resentencing. Thank you for your time, and I would be happy to stand for any questions you or the committee may have.
Thank you. Are there any other members, are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is maybe to the bill's author or to Commissioner Schnell. On 4.19 through 4.26, you're really broadening access to basically any data that the commissioner deems necessary. What data will be made available through this language that you already don't have access to?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, this would be any data that would be necessary in order for us to fulfill our obligation to conduct an assessment relative to was the facility in compliance with the standards that the state has relative to the operation of a correctional facility, in this case in a county jail, or could be a detention facility, a juvenile detention facility. And so it would depend upon the facts of a particular incident or situation that that would be what data we would need to get. So that could be medical, it could be documents related to rounds that were conducted. It could be a broad range of data. It's really fact specific.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you address a little bit what the problem was before adding this section? Were you having trouble getting data? Why do we have this new language?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, yes, there were situations where we might have had There may have been a review, for instance, a death would occur in a county jail. And there, while the Department of Corrections has a responsibility to conduct a review of that death relative to the jail standards, was the jail in compliance with the standards, there is also a death investigation that occurs generally by law enforcement, whether that's being done by the county or a local law enforcement agency. What was happening in some instances is that we were profoundly delayed in our ability to do any reviews because the data was being held up. Now, even though there are provisions in data practices which would allow government-to-government sharing of the data, there was the concern on the part of some counties that sharing that data was problematic. This would make explicit that relative to a situation, a review that we need to conduct to fulfill our obligation, we would be able to access and obtain that data.
And Commissioner, related to that, are there still counties who contract out with non-governmental entities for medical care in their facilities?
Madam Chair, yes, there are.
Okay, thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's super broad language, and I understand you need what you need to conduct an investigation. I don't know, it just kind of gives me a squishy feeling, but I do want to thank you for addressing the issue with the victims. Not all of them want to have their information made public, and so this gives them the option to control that. So I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other discussion to the bill? Representative Tabke, closing comments.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, for the conversation. And thank you, Chair, Commissioner Schnell, for your work on this bill to get where we need to be in the DOC policy. So thank you.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House Bill 4048 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Representative, do we have Representative Edelson? Yes. The time of year when everyone's running around to different committee hearings before deadlines, so I don't want to move a bill if the author's not in the room. All right, Representative Edelson, I will move to refer House File 4366 to the Health Finance Committee. Please tell us about your bill.
All right, well, good morning, Madam Chair and members. Before you is House Bill 4366 of the Priority of Mission Law, which is the result of a task force that had met regarding civil commitments in the state of Minnesota. I just want to highlight from the task force that civil commitments for persons that have been civilly committed have risen 40% in the last year. And that's a lot. And so what we're dealing with is a strain on our systems, and the Priority of Missions group had worked on that over the last year. We have many recommendations, what you're going to see in the bill today. Many of it will overlap with you, but specifically I will say I know that you have the expanded funding for the forensic examiners in your bill today, or in your I think you have already heard it, or you're carrying that chair. It's also in the task force recommendations.
We don't have targets yet, so I'm not carrying anybody's money yet. But for the record, Representative Edelson, go ahead.
Okay, good. Well, it's in this bill too. So, and then I also have that one I know would definitely overlap for judiciary, but it would also be the administration of medications in jails. But on the task force, it was hospital, sheriffs, NAMI, direct care and treatment, a great deal of very experienced people that are overlapping and dealing with the strains of this increase on our system. The 48-hour rule, which we currently have, is not working, and we are continuing to meet twice a week. This bill has been to three committees. It has several more, and so I'm happy to take any questions.
All right. And just for member purposes, we're just going to focus on the provisions that brought the bill to this committee for member discussion. Any members of the public wishing to testify? We've got Sue Abderholden. If there's anyone else wishing to testify, now would be the time. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. When the 48-hour bill passed, it was to make sure that people with serious mental illnesses didn't languish in jail after they were committed. It's important to note that people are in jail for months before they are committed. For the first few years, it worked, but then an increasing number of people were deemed incompetent to stand trial and committed, and an increasing number of people in Minnesota are struggling with their mental health. And so now the only people who get into state-operated programs are people from jails. Yet we have a small number of people in community hospitals who do need to be at Anoka and have been in a hospital without access to fresh air for over a year, and units have actually taken beds offline due to that person's severe symptoms, creating, frankly, increased boarding in the ER. The task force was created to develop recommendations for how we could address, frankly, this impossible situation. The bill reflects the idea that we need to expand direct care and treatment so more people can get into Anoka, a community behavioral health hospital, or the security hospital, and we need to provide more treatment in jails. But we also need to go upstream and prevent so many people from going into jail in the first place, and we need to make sure that we move people out of the beds at the state-operated programs so that we can open up beds. We need to do all of this to chip away at the problem. While task force members are in agreement on many things, there is one big issue that remains: whether we keep a specific time period in which someone needs to be transferred out of the jail once committed. I'm here to ask you not to place a timeline in statute, that we instead rely on the proposed criteria as to who gets in first, who is prioritized. Putting in a timeline simply leads to litigation, like in Washington State, and we had a handout that we put out on the table. 10 years and $400 million in fines later, they fail to meet the timeline 93% of the time. Why? Because timelines don't matter when you don't have open beds and when you can't hire staff. We've been told that we need to have a timeline to hold DHS accountable. I'm almost done. I'll quit. I ask accountable for what? The workforce crisis is beyond their control. They can only add beds if you appropriate the money. Arbitrary deadlines don't equal access. The reality is that there's not an open bed. A person can't be moved no matter what timeline is established. The reality is that all the players in the mental health system need to be held accountable and need to be engaged to build our mental health system. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We will move on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Pinn, Representative. I got a little bit of an explanation of why the 48-hour rule is being changed. I think it's important to get those people sitting in custody the help they need as soon as possible. But what's the main cause for and reason why we have to change that rule?
Representative Johnson, I'll let Representative Edelson answer the question, but we're just going to stick to our discussion to the data sharing and the outcome evaluation sections, which is why this bill is in this committee. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, civil commitments have gone up dramatically. You know, I've said 40%. We have one person that is sitting in a hospital that has been there for 2 years, and I see we have the nurses here today. There has been 157 assaults to nurses at one of the hospitals. We do not have the right beds. And so in the bill, in the we're meeting behind the scenes. Yeah, we have the expansion of 10 beds immediately, which is the importance of passing this legislation. It's expanding and increasing capacity at DCT, which will take years, 10 to 20%. And so the reason we have to remove the 48-hour rule is that it's not working, and it is causing litigation, as Ms. Abdra Holden said, to our state. It will decimate our mental health system. We have to build capacity. We have to protect staff. Trust me, I don't love this issue. This is very hard for me as a clinician, but like we have to do something, and this is not my problem. This is all of ours.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Pinn, the representative. That was an issue I had concerns with when we passed that 48-hour rule. Unfortunately, we've had numerous beds removed up from our system over the last few years. I lost track of how many beds we lost. And with one of the side effects of narcotics use, which actually brings a lot of people to jail because of the other crimes they admit to do, to work with their addiction, one of the main things that happen with a serious drug use is mental health issues. So it's the drug use and the addiction issue all relate with the mental health use. We need to start getting drug treatment, not just in the state prison system. We need to start getting drug programs in our local jails so we can get them off the narcotics, fix their issues, and hopefully have less people going into that, getting into that situation.
Representative Johnson, that was very much a health committee or public safety committee comment, so I let it go. But members, really, we need to stick to why the bills are in our committee, or we're not going to be able to get through everything that needs to come through here. Any other discussion to the bill? Oh, Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you so much, again, Representative Edelson. I know I've seen you before a couple other committees before this stop, and I just, again, want to reiterate, really appreciate the attention to this that you've put in. I know that you're really passionate about this, and you're putting in the work several times a week. In this committee, I'll specifically say that I really appreciate the attention to detail in the data collection and how we use that information, because as we say a lot, when we know better, we can do better. And I think this is a perfect example. So thank you.
Representative Edelson, hopefully you're keeping an eye out for who can continue this work when you're no longer here. I don't think this is a one and done issue. You've been working on the whole time you've been here. So I do thank you for your work on this. Any other member discussion? All right. Not seeing any closing comments. Representative Edelson.
Thank you for your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 4366 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Ryer. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. I will move to refer House File 4210 to the Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Ryer, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Becker, Chair Becker Finn and members. We all deserve a safe workplace. That's why I'm pleased to be in front of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee today to talk about one section within House File 4210, the Hospital Safety Bill. Overall, this bill is offered in response to the increasing violence in hospitals, which has in turn resulted in many nurses leaving the bedside rather than having to cope with these high-risk and stressful working conditions. This bill builds on and integrates with the progress made in last year's Nurse and Patient Safety Act, which made important improvements to training, action planning, reporting of violent workplace incidents. And it moves us toward a more systemic solution rather than piecemeal responses. It has three main sections. Hospitals must provide de-escalation training for most patient-facing workers. Hospitals must establish violent interruption intervention teams to increase the resources available in hospitals to assist with violent incidents. And there are also additional logging and reporting requirements related to emergency department departures and violent incidents that occur in the hospital. But today we're here to talk about subdivision 14, that's on the back page, the last section, and it's the limited immunity section. This section states that individuals working in a hospital shall not be subject to civil or criminal liability for good faith compliance with the hospital's violence interruption program. It also protects licensed medical professionals and licensed mental health professionals from professional disciplinary action for complying with that program. These are important protections to ensure that the structures put in place to create a safer workplace can be fully utilized by the people they are intended to benefit. With that, Chair Becker Finn, I will be happy to take questions and look forward to hearing the testimony.
Yep. First on the list, I have Jennifer Armbrust, and then I have Elena Hain on deck. And if Elena Hain can also come on up now, that would be great.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Jennifer Armbrus, and I am a registered nurse. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of HF 4210, the Improving Safety in Hospitals Act.
And Ms. Armbrus, if you can just, our mics aren't the greatest, you can just tip it towards you a little bit more. Thank you.
Yes.
Go ahead.
What does it mean to be safe in my workplace? I do not know. Speaking as an ER nurse, the most assaulted specialty within the most assaulted profession in the United States, I have been assaulted innumerably. I did not sign up for this. I chose the life of a professional healer. It is my calling to help the wounded, treat the ill, and comfort the dying. I'm not a wrestler, boxer, correctional officer, or bouncer. Yet I have been grabbed, scratched, punched, kicked, and molested. Being safe at work should not be a privilege. It is a right that is being denied to us. Last year, Essentia Health has exacerbated this issue. At St. Mary's in Duluth, security has been cut in half. My peers are assaulted, often weekly, in my department. Many nurses are being asked by management what we could have done differently, rather than asking how the organization could better protect us. Beyond their victim blaming, pressure on our profession tells us to put ourselves in harm's way, not just as an exploitation of our dedication to patients, but as an implied threat to our jobs and our licenses. In the community, EMS is required to wait until a scene is safe before intervening. If a first responder becomes a casualty, not only are they unable to care for the patient, but also then require care and draw on resources. This is not just self-preservation, it's pragmatic. Healthcare workers should have the same protection within the hospital because our employers fail to protect us. Nurses should be safe to preserve themselves from harm in dangerous situations rather than becoming casualties. Nurses should also not be blamed for trying to help. This is the choice I want to give to nurses with this legislation. Please pass HF 4210 today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, I have Elena Hain. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Sure. Excuse me. Good morning, Chair Becker-Finn and committee members. My name is Elena Hain, and I've been a registered nurse for 22 years, and I'm proud to be the interim executive director of the Minnesota Nurses Association. More importantly, I am one of the thousands of registered nurses across Minnesota who have left the bedside because of the constant pressures of unsafe staffing, increasing violence, and the moral injury associated with hospitals prioritizing their bottom lines over patient care. Due to hospitals across the state failing to implement appropriate safety measures to protect their workforce and their patients, nurses are pleading with you to pass House File 4210, the Improving Safety in Hospitals Act. This legislation will increase safety measures and provide the support that direct patient care staff need to deliver quality patient care. Even though hospitals were mandated in 2016 with the law to create workplace violence prevention plans, hospitals like Bagley currently have no protection if somebody shows up to their hospital with a deadly weapon. Their choices, according to their workplace violence prevention plan, are to call the county sheriff and hope that they're close enough to respond and not on the other side of the county, or to call the security of their sister hospital in Bemidji. However, Bemidji security officers do not drive to Bagley to provide any support. This leaves direct patient care staff stuck trying to respond to situations without having appropriate safety measures in place. The problem is that this isn't just Bagley. Situations like these are happening to nurses across the state. The language that is up for review today merely asks that when a direct care staff person responds to a crisis in accordance with their hospital policy and within the constraints of their license, that they have good Samaritan protections like most other professionals who interact within circumstances that put their own lives at risk. On average, two nurses are assaulted every hour. I will repeat, two nurses are assaulted every hour. They need your support to ensure that they respond in good faith effort, that they are protected, their job is protected, and their license is protected. Please pass House File 4210 today and make hospitals safer for workers and patients. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Matthew Bergeron.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Matthew Bergeron. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Larkin Hoffman and here today on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association. While the Minnesota Hospital Association has concerns with House File 4210, particularly the requirement that hospitals always have a four-person behavioral health intervention team on duty, as they believe it would draw away from too many mental health professionals from seeing patients both in the hospitals and the community. That being said, MHA continues to work with Representative Ryer and appreciates the ongoing conversation. MHA does, however, support the language in Subdivision 14 before this committee today that provides civil, criminal, and professional licensing immunity for hospital employees when they engage in good faith conduct in compliance with the hospital's intervention program. The Hospital Association would like to see that language broadened to include contracted workers, whether that be nurses or security staff, just to ensure that everyone working in a hospital is protected. But MHA does have some concerns that the proposed immunity language actually doesn't go far enough as a whole and would create a new liability for the hospital itself. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held that a hospital owns individuals a duty of care to protect them from injury, from others when they're in the hospital, and when appropriate, control the conduct of a potentially dangerous individual. In this context, that means that hospitals have a common law duty to respond to incidents of violence. And if they breach that duty and someone is injured, there's a potential cause of action against the hospital. However, the court has also recognized the concept of negligence per se, meaning that a party who violates a statute or regulation is automatically considered to have breached the duty of care and is therefore negligent in a matter of law. It's kind of sets aside the fact-specific examination. MHA is concerned about the instance where a hospital staff make the good faith efforts that were described earlier in testimony to manage a behavioral health crisis in compliance with the provisions of this bill, but execution isn't perfect. These situations are dynamic and unpredictable, and somebody is injured. Just as MHA believes that the staff who did their best under difficult circumstances should be immune from civil and criminal liability, it believes the hospital should be too, and respectfully requests that language be added to Subdivision 14 that would reflect that same good faith effort in compliance with the regulation. Lastly, I would point out that adding such language would have no impact on the ability of an injured individual to bring suit if the hospital failed to make a good faith effort or otherwise breached their duty of care and acted negligently. It would simply limit a new cause of action that would come out of a more regulated environment in this space. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Breyer for your bill. I just have a couple of comments. I support the immunity clause, and I support our nurses, and I'm thankful that you are all here today. This is one of these where I think it's really frustrating to be supporting a little piece of immunity rather than solving the problem that we're talking about, which is the failure of hospitals to protect their employees, right? Like, we should do this. This isn't going to solve the problem that we're facing. And then to hear the Minnesota hospitals say that they want to also have immunity, but they actually oppose the parts of the bill that might actually address the problem is especially disconcerting. If you don't want to take action, support action to change the problem, providing immunity to our nurses is only putting more of the responsibility on our nurses. You should be immune from these actions, but we should actually solve the real problem, which is that hospitals are not providing safe environments for their workers. So the idea that we would also provide immunity for hospitals who are testifying in opposition to the meat of this bill to try to solve it is beyond ironic. Well, that's all. Thank you so much.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Thank you, Representative Ryer, for taking on this issue. Thank you to the nurses who showed up here to advocate for themselves and for their colleagues. Everybody agrees that they should be safe in their workplace. I guess where I maybe disagree, Representative Finke, with the idea that this the meat of this is what solves the problem, is I heard testimony about nurses not being bouncers or boxers and about the need for security, and I don't see that in the meat of the bill or in the immunity provisions. And so I guess my question for you, Representative Ryer, is it Are the response teams that are getting this immunity, do they include or should they include, and would you be willing to work with the hospitals to make sure that they include people who are actually trained and equipped to do to engage in the physical security part of the actually being able to interrupt violence happening at the hospital? Because the way that it's worded, at least the bill right now, it seems to be focused on taking mental health professionals away from being able to deal with, you know, patients and having them on standby waiting for some violence to happen, but not having anybody who would actually be able to, you know, immediately intervene in the violence, you know, train and equip to do that. So, you know, how can we fix in both the immunity provision but the broader bill to deal with that issue?
And I'll just note that on line 12.7, it's no individual employed to work in a hospital is the definition in the bill. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you, Representative Niska. I appreciate that. And what I would say is that the meat of this bill is a solution for part of the whole system of a hospital. We had a bill passed just last year that addressed other aspects of safety. The other thing I'd like to say, though, is that the conversation about the response teams, the intervention teams, is not complete. We are still working with the hospitals, specifically looking at different needs depending on the different type of hospitals, critical access hospitals, for example, versus another, a larger hospital in an urban setting, and talking about how do we look at what they're doing and build a system that has both accountability and flexibility to recognize those things.
Representative Niska.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that, the expression of that, you know, willingness to continue to work with the hospitals to deal with that. And I, Chair Becker-Finn, I think the issue with respect to the language you referenced is that at least the hospitals seem to be concerned that that might not include all of their security personnel, some of whom are contracted with the hospital. Maybe that can be clarified, or I mean, it may be an
trying to keep us to what's in front of us in this committee. We're all getting a little bit farther afield than we need to, but that was my point in bringing us back to the language. But go ahead, Representative Niska.
Fair enough, and that was where I was trying to tie it to the language in the bill. But I appreciate that this is still a work in progress. I don't think it's quite ready yet, but I appreciate the goals that you're trying to accomplish. I think that the hospitals also are, you know, want their nurses to have a safe workplace environment. I hope we can find a way to work together on that. Thanks.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative for bringing this bill forward to try to help protect our hospital staff. Being a father of a nurse and someone who is a young lady who is right on the front lines, gets right in there trying to help people do the same thing, help them to heal, get better. But you're going to have to I'm glad you're going to keep working with the hospitals to try to fine-tune this thing, because like the one testifier said, the hospital in Bagley, I was a Clearwater County deputy, so I did work in that area, and that is a very big concern for those rural hospitals, rural settings, is that you can be at one end of the county and be the only deputy on call, and it'll take you an hour to get there, going as fast as you possibly can safely to try to get there to help somebody. And by that time, it's too late. It's too late. We do need to address this, and I did try to address this early on in serving in the legislature with lifting hospital staff and nurses and firefighters to be under the same protection as peace officers in fourth degree assault. It passed off the House floor unanimously. It moved through our committees and was accepted unanimously in the House. Unfortunately, it got to the Senate and got turned into some kind of abomination, and therefore got pulled out of the conference committee. So that is something that, and I have asked for in years past, here again, I've tried to get hearings for it, but it couldn't get those. So that I hope somebody will look at that to try to, it's protection after the fact, but lifting them to hospital nurses and staffs, lifting them beyond the emergency room area to the entire hospital to protect them would be something that that should be done. Minnesota Nurses Association supported it. The County Attorneys Association supported it. Right on down the line, the law enforcement community supported it. So, you know, please, somebody pick that up again and see if, what you can do with that. You know, it'll help. It'll help protect our nurses. It'll help protect the whole hospital staff. Again, doing a little bit of security work now myself in my retirement time, I have to go to some of the hospitals in the local areas to sit with people who are under a watch where they need to have a security person sitting outside their door 24 hours a day as long as they're in that hospital. You're going to need somebody that that can address that problem immediately. So if the security, if you can find a way to help to pull the security underneath that umbrella of getting that that immunity so that they can help the staff to regain control of an individual who is trying to hurt them. Now, of course, we're hearing everything. Representative Edelson's bill working on the mental health issues, and right now they're going to be in the hospitals. And, you know, they can still hurt people, whether they want to or whether they realize it or not. Okay, but there are bad actors who also come in there. They might be a family member, a friend, or whatever, and don't like what's going on, so they get unruly and hurt people. Those are the people that my bill would address. And of course, if you can work that out with the hospitals and try to get that, the security personnel under that protection, then they can also be able to do the work that needs to be done to help hospital staff. With that, again, keep working on it, please.
There are a lot of reasons people's bills don't get heard in this place. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Ryer for bringing this important bill. It's part of a number of bills that are all designed to create different systems and incentives and protections that will ensure that our hospitals are safely staffed, because we know that unsafe staffing directly correlates with workplace violence. And it's really shocking and sad to hear the stories of nurses about what they've experienced when all they're doing is dedicating their lives to care. So I thank you for bringing this really important bill, and I thank the nurses for being there to help guide us in our policymaking.
Representative Johnson. And we do have two other bills, so I'll just remind everybody that the question here before us is whether there should be liability for people employed in hospitals in these situations. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Ryer, I understand the concept you do here. I want to make sure our nurses and our hospital staff is safe as well. I do have some concerns on what's missing in the immunity section. It says that no individual employed in the hospital shall be subject to civil or criminal liability. Problem is, we don't know if that includes those that are contracted. Many of the security officers at our hospitals across, especially in greater Minnesota, they're contracted. They're not hospital staff. So I don't believe the way this bill is written, they'd be covered. The violence interrupter concept, everybody should be trained in that. All law enforcement officers have some type of training in that. It comes from experience, learning how to talk to the people. Because generally the ones that we're dealing with that need to be calmed down have mental health issues. And it takes a special person and a special way to talk with them. Sometimes a soft voice works. Sometimes loud orders work. You don't know until you talk to them. Every situation is different. So it makes it, when you're doing protocols, it makes it very difficult because, as I said, each situation is different. But with your violence interrupters teams that you have listed in your security officers are not listed. They're an important part of the violence interrupter. The main thing that a lot of times calms people down is the presence of that uniform. The security officers wear a uniform. And that shows, and generally a lot of times, just that presence of that uniform calms things down. But you're leaving them off this team. And I think it's an important person to be on that team. And I wish you would consider adding the security officers onto that immunity, because like I said, a lot of them are not employed by the hospital. They're contracted out for security. And a lot of them are off-duty police officers that have that specialized in training and understand how to deal with those individuals in crisis.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Chair Beckerfin, thank you. Representative Ryer, I think has already been said, everybody wants our nurses to be safe in the workplace. There are nurses within my family, and they put up with a lot from patients and from the patients' guests and so forth, or visitors, family, whatever. In talking to the nurses that I know, they didn't sign up to be violence interrupters. And my fear with the liability section of this is that we're going to have nurses that are put on the front line of trying to quell really challenging situations with people that, you know, it may be drug induced, but they may outweigh and outpower a nurse. And my fear is that more nurses are going to be harmed in being on the front line of this. And with no security individuals as a piece of that team, I worry more about the nurses' safety than I do now, because I feel like it's going to be these same people that are going to be, I can't imagine the burnout rate. If you get, you know, one head injury, are you really going to bounce back and want to be a part of this team continually? So, and my concern here too is these nurses are going to be harmed, and then they're going to want to turn around and sue the hospitals. And what I'd like to see really is for us to take a little bit of a break here. We just passed a law last year about hospital safety. The hospitals are working to implement that. There's a report due out, I think, next year. Why can't we wait and see what's happening as a result of a bill that has not even been in place for a year and see if this is really needed, or learn from that report to see how this might be tweaked or maybe addressed in a different way based on the data. So, Representative Ryer, do you have any concerns at all that we're actually putting more nurses in harm's way that could turn around then with this liability piece because hospitals aren't covered and sue the hospitals? Does that concern you at all?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott. When I look at what we are suggesting putting in place, we are not saying that any nurse will be assigned to a team like this. We are not putting nurses involuntarily in that role. What we are doing is giving all of the people who are patient-facing, and I think about the stress level for a billing clerk when someone comes into the hospital. I think about the nurses. I am a former dietary aide. I think about the dietary aides. And no, I don't think this makes them less safe. Putting systems in place to build safety with people who have the skills to come into a situation that's beyond the skills of the bedside nurse or the ED staff or whoever is there increases safety. to me, it's hard to take a mental leap to saying that that causes people to be less safe. That said, I will reiterate that we are still looking at what the teams, who they include, how they are adaptable to different circumstances, and I'll certainly be taking all of the feedback into account.
Thank you. Representative Scott, any follow-up?
Madam Chair, I just think this is going to harm more people. I think it's going to cause injury to more people, and I just wonder how many will actually sign up for this gig. It's very concerning to me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Ryer, closing comments.
Thank you for the discussion, the consideration of this bill. Thank you to the nurses for being here to support it, and I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 4210 to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ryer. And thank you to our testifiers. Representative Stevenson. I will move to recommend House File 4400 be placed on the General Register. Doesn't look like we have any author's amendments, so Representative Stevenson, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 4400 results from a report that we instructed the Attorney General to prepare last year related to social media, particularly its impact on mental health, particularly for young people. The bill sets up a framework that's designed to ensure privacy of users and protecting children. We do have a video that I'm not sure it's going to work. If it's not, then I'll do my best. But the Attorney General's office prepared a short video that explains the bill well, but I'm not sure it's going to work. So. Let me know when
it was. It was set up and looked like it was ready to go, like three bills ago.
Before the hearing, it seemed to be fine.
Welcome to technology in our committees. I don't think there's a video that's worked in any of the committees I've been on this year, to be honest. So it's not any one person's problem. There, the screen woke up. That seems good.
Hey,
that seems good.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Now it's always fun to find out if the audio works. The audio we can't hear. Does the TV itself have a volume knob as well? Okay. Can we maybe move it? Can we roll it closer and maybe move that mic that way? This is very, very high tech.
It's like 90s tech.
I assume future committee rooms will have technology that's from this century. That is a big speaker, but I don't think the bigger the speaker is actually. All right, let's try this again.
So the bill has four main features. By default, responsible amplification, acceptable rate limits, and then mandating not encouraging greater usage of privacy for children. And then it also includes some provisions around transparency so we can understand future risk that may be revealed by product experimentation and design choices. So we talk about each of these in turn. I'll start by privacy by default. You'll see your quote.
I don't think anyone's actually able to hear it based on people whispering to each other. So, all right. Representative Stevenson, I trust that you can explain the bill without a video.
Yeah,
please
is,
go ahead.
It is a good video, but we will...
We'll send it out to committee members.
Grab your mic.
And I'll do that.
Grab your mic. Thank you. It is on YouTube, so we can send the video around. So
I don't let my kids go on YouTube.
But Mr. Iyer, a good idea, I think. What Mr. Iyer was saying is there are four components to the bill. One, privacy by default. Second, responsible amplification. Third, sensible rate limits. Fourth, do not encourage greater use for children. And then there are some transparency requirements designed to highlight emerging issues. So the first component is requiring privacy by default. A lot of the bad outcomes we see on social media, particularly involving children, begin with unwanted contact from strangers. And that's facilitated by loose privacy defaults and it has really severe consequences for youth. And there's a lot of stories out there. I actually was just reading one that was sent to me yesterday about bad actors who reach out to young women on social media, convince them to send compromising photos, and then use them to blackmail them into committing violent acts of self-harm for basically their entertainment. This is a really dark and disgusting area of the world that so far we don't have haven't taken adequate policy responses to. So requiring privacy as the default setting that then users would be in control of an ability to change if that's what they want, making sure that people's account and content aren't publicly visible and can't be integrated into AI models. And this ties into the deepfake laws that we've passed in the past, a very common problem with deepfakes. I think most members here think about a lot in the election context. The other half of that bill was AI-generated pornography, where people take publicly available images of people and superimpose them on other people's bodies, or AI-generated bodies to create pornography. Requiring that messages can't originate outside an account user's existing extended network, friends of friends, but users can initiate messages and connections, can't reveal location, content from users can't be forwarded to others. The second issue is responsible amplification. I think what many people don't appreciate is on many social media platforms, a very small amount of users create a mass amount of content. So what the bill does is creates a framework where that's designed to kind of curtail some of these bots and new users, dark users, to create a more open marketplace of ideas. Tied into this is the responsible amplification. So we've all had the experience where we're online looking at a social media thing and we see an image that maybe we didn't want to see but keeps our eyes focused on it, like something that's extremely violent or something that's extremely explicit. It's not that you necessarily wanted to see that, but when it shows up on your feed, it's hard to turn your eyes away. The way that oftentimes algorithms operate is the longer you're staring at something or if you click or interact with it, it suggests to the algorithm that you want to see more of that content. So what the bill says is two things. One, the platform has to give you the ability to rate content. And most social media platforms already do. This is like hitting like on Facebook or upvoting or downvoting on Reddit. The important thing is the second piece, which is it requires the platform to prioritize your instructions over just prioritizing engagement. So in other words, if you see that violent or explicit image on your Facebook or Reddit or whatever, and you downvote it or you click and say, I don't want to see as much of this, the platform can't show you more of that just because you were looking at it, right? Because remember, their business model is to keep your eyes on the screen. So they have every incentive to show you things that will keep you looking at it, even if it's things you have told them you don't want to see. And we're putting the user in charge with that provision. We want to encourage platforms not to just keep kids staring at the screens as much as possible, kind of the similar theory that they shouldn't create the product in such a way that it keeps kids on there, particularly as a default option. So if you look at the bill, you'll see that for kids, there needs to be a default setting of privacy and other controls, including things like no autoplay that's just going to keep kids on the screen forever and ever. These are things that can be changed by parents, but again, we're putting parents in the driver's seat there. So if a preference has been made, if a control's been placed on, the platform has to honor it after this. And then the last thing is the transparency. you know, this is an area of technology that's always evolving. There's a lot of experimentation going on. And frankly, I think if social media companies are going to be running experiments on our kids, we have a right to know about it. And we should be able to see what they're doing. And so we're requiring transparency. So that's the bill. It's enforced by the Attorney General and currently a private right of action, though I think we're about to talk about that in an amendment. And I'm happy to answer questions.
All right. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on the underlying bill? All right, not seeing any. Sounds like you're ready to talk about the A2 amendment. Representative Niska, I believe that's yours.
Yes, thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And I move the A2 amendment, which is a continuation of a discussion that Chair Stevenson and I had in the Commerce Committee. First of all, I appreciate the work you put in the discussions that we've had, and I know you've had with other people around this issue. I do think for a couple of reasons it would be better to not have a private right of action in this bill. And first of all, I think it's important to think about what we're trying to regulate, what this bill would be aimed at, which is not about any particular person's personal experience with a social media platform, but more broadly how that social media platform is presented and how it empowers all of its consumers or doesn't empower all of its consumers in the state of Minnesota. And so I think that as we're looking at that, and especially as we're thinking about, I think there are some of the points from the industry and some of the letters that are fair points about some of the language being broad and maybe a little bit undefined. I think some of the points are not really, I don't agree with, for example, that it's that unclear what allowing a user to decide whether something is high or low quality. I think that is, at least it's clear to me. But as we're thinking about this emerging technology space, I think it would be better, it would work out better if we had one central place of, working out what the law means with the people, with the companies that are being regulated, rather than having a private right of action, and even, a private right of action through 8.31, where different plaintiff's lawyers might be bringing cases in different places, and we're kind of leaving it to the litigation process in a bunch of different cases in a bunch of different courts potentially to regulate in this area. So I think that this would work a lot better in a lot of ways if it was simply the Attorney General enforcing it. I appreciate the fiscal note that the Attorney General's office gave, which was basically what I think we've all seen. The Attorney General's office is making consumer regulation and regulation in this area already a high priority. This is kind of just folding into that. So I think that that's the best way to handle this. So that's the purpose of the A2 amendment.
Representative Stevenson, response.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. I'm going to encourage members to vote yes on the A2 amendment. As I have thought about this, and I made the comment in the Commerce Committee that bad cases make bad law, and so I tend to agree that given the fact that this is an emerging area of law, given its close proximity to, or that's not even an understatement, the First Amendment and the challenges involved there, I think having the Attorney General exercise discretion in deciding which cases to pursue and cases not to pursue will help the law develop in a better way than just opening up. I'm usually a fan of private rights of action, so this is a little bit out of character for me to say this, but in this particular case, I think it, at least initially, I think it would be good for it to be all through the Attorney General's office. So I would encourage a yes vote.
Lots of people are fans of civil ways of holding people accountable, hence our very long lists of bills we get to hear in this committee. Any other discussion to the A2? Representative Scott.
At the risk of losing the vote on the A2 or A1 out of the A2, I just want to thank the other side. Maybe this is precedent setting. You'll start taking more Republican amendments, but I encourage a yes vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Write good amendments, and we can talk about it. further discussion to the A2. All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Congratulations, Representative Nisbet. any further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this really important bill. I just read an article this morning that I feel the need to talk about because it's very relevant to this. It was called The Terrible Costs of a Phone-Based Childhood. And the data is so stark about how phones and social media have impacted youth, the levels of anxiety, of suicide, are so stark, and they're international, and they really can't be described or explained by anything except for like the way we have immersed ourselves in technology. They talk about the lack of risk taking and ambition in young people because they're so tied to their phones and how technology and social media has impacted their emotional growth, the sense of meaningless, and the article kind of ended by saying we have a collective action problem, that we all agree social media is toxic and we'd all like to be off of it. I actually was almost off of it until I decided to run for office, and then I felt like I had to be on. It was very sad. But the article said that, you know, the federal government hasn't been able to do anything proactive, and it falls to the states to do so. And so it's really hard to legislate around technology and around these emerging issues and to get ahead of them. And I just appreciate you tackling this so much. This is so important. So thank you.
I encourage you to quit Twitter and pick up Pokemon Go instead. Representative Nisca.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you again, Representative Stevenson. And, you know, we had a, like I said, we had a discussion about this topic, both in the Commerce Committee, and I appreciate the other conversations we've had offline. I will just say, you know, I do think that there are still some language that can be tweaked. And so because the motion here is to put it on the general register, I don't think it's quite ready. But I understand that there's, you know, continuing discussion that's going to happen. And a lot of that is outside of the jurisdiction of this committee. So we don't need to get too far down that road. Obviously, difficult constitutional issues that we're dealing with here. I would say that, you know, when we're talking about regulating the safety of or the experience that a consumer has, even when they're consuming protected First Amendment things, there are things we can do to regulate the experience that a consumer has and whether they're being taken advantage of. In the same way we can regulate, you know, a bookstore, just even though it is selling books, we can regulate aspects of, you know, the safety of a bookstore, for example. So I appreciate that this is, I think, a real good faith effort to try to stay on the right side of that line. I had some conversations with some industry people about ways that maybe some of the language can be fixed, and hopefully that we can continue to have those conversations as it goes forward. But I don't think it's ready yet, so I'm not going to vote to put it on the general register, but I appreciate the conversations we've had and continued work that I know you're going to have on this. So thanks.
If I lay it over, it'll die in 8 days. So we're going to move it there, I hope. and members, I'll remind you, we got one more bill. People keep adding themselves to the list, and it's fine to have the discussion, but we do have to get to the other bill that's on our agenda today. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Stevens, thanks for working on this. This is a serious issue, but how we do it without violating our Constitution, both state and federal, is challenging. I'm not sure how it's going to work because we have places across the state like Taylor's Falls and St. Croix Falls, Duluth and Superior, Fargo-Moorhead, where if you're on one side of a bridge, you're in Minnesota. If you're on the other side of the bridge, you're in a different state. Up in International Falls, you go across the border, you're in a different country. Are these companies that do this stuff actually going to have to put a geofence around the entire border of the state of Minnesota? Because you could actually be using your phone or your device over the cell phone system and be on an antenna that's in a different state or a different country and actually would be able to get the information that you're trying to stop. And then they could be sued, even though they either weren't in the state or their equipment wasn't in the state that they happened to connect to. Do we need to do something about this to make sure our kids are safe and that some of this content is taken care of? Absolutely. Some of these things are actually coming from out of the country. So I appreciate what you're doing, but even at the federal level, dealing with TikTok, they're having issues because of our Constitution. Like I say, I appreciate what you're doing, but I think this needs to be something done more at the federal level because we do have interstate commerce that we're dealing with. And if I remember correctly, there is some court rulings already dealing with interstate commerce, and so I'm not sure how this is going to work or not.
This bill was started in the Commerce Committee, and Representative Niska and Representative Stevenson, I'm sure, had conversations. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Rebecca Finn and Representative Stevenson, for your bill. Like everyone, I'm concerned about this issue. I just would ask that, you know, we recognize with, you know, humility that everyone in this room is light years behind what is happening on the internet with our kids. I had a conversation with some young people on my block, actually, about YouTube being banned on their school iPads, and they all kind of laughed about that. Because, yeah, it's banned on their iPads, and they all watch YouTube on their school iPads, right? Like, what's happening is so far beyond what we are even, like, starting to think about. And we need to be really, we need to weigh our constitutional First Amendment rights. We also need to, like, recognize that we are not consumers on social media. Social media companies are designed to consume people and our data and then sell that data, right? They only show us what they show us so that they can consume our data. Their product is us. We provide it to them, and then they sell it. So the idea that we are somehow beholden to these companies to protect our First Amendment rights is really, it's the greatest trick the devil ever pulled, right? That somehow this is how we are being able to use our speech when really they are just selling us constantly to people who are in the market for us. So I appreciate this work. We need to make sure that we are doing everything we can to keep our kids safe, and we need to recognize that the way that we understand social media is the great hoodwink.
Thank you. Representative Scott. And then we're going to vote.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Question on line 3.24. As far as the scope and exclusions, that section 3, item number 2 there, has more than 10,000 monthly active users. Representative Stevenson, is that in Minnesota or is that broader than that?
I'll allow you to answer this question, but this really doesn't have to do with the enforcement liability piece. Go ahead, Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I appreciate the question. I think it's in Minnesota, but this has been flagged by a stakeholder that I talked to as something that we could probably clarify going forward. So it's something we're paying attention to, but it's in Minnesota is the intent.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would say that actually that does address the liability because we need to know who's going to be liable. And so in the definition of social media platform, there's been some discussion about online educational platforms that where students are sharing, questions, problems, sharing notes, that sort of thing. And would they also be lumped into the social media platform definition?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I don't intend this to be a dodge. I really don't. I think it's going to very much depend on what the platform is doing and how it operates compared to the definitions here. So is it possible that you could have an educational program that falls within this definition? Absolutely. Does that mean every single one will? Certainly not. So I can't get more specific than that. I think it's possible.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and I'll just add, too, as I was reading through the bill, too, I think
if some of these software programs and apps are such good actors, then they won't mind being held accountable in the same way that you're trying to hold other businesses accountable. So it's sort of, oh no, I'm a social media platform, but like, okay, great. Well, then don't do these bad behaviors, and you know, we're reining in some of those things. And I'm not sure that that's, I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily if we pull more people into that definition. So thank you, members, for the discussion. Closing comments, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, appreciate the discussion today. And I Representative Finke's comments remind me of one of my favorite cartoons I've seen as a pig at a farm. And the pig says, God, isn't this great? We don't have to pay for our housing. We don't have to pay for our food. We get to just hang out all day. It's so wonderful. And meanwhile, the slaughterhouse is in the background. And it makes you remember that in the context of social media, it's wonderful that these are free products that we all have enjoyment from, but there's a reason why we don't have to pay for that, because, as Representative Finke said, we are the product that they are selling there. It's also true that this is an emerging area of law. It's a difficult one, and I wish there was a federal solution to this problem. I wish the federal government would do something. I think I heard Representative Garofalo say the other day, the opposite of progress is Congress. I think we cannot wait for the federal government to act. We need to protect our kids. So I ask members for a yes vote.
All right. I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 4400, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Representative Hollins. I will move to refer House File 2319 to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee, and I understand that you have an A1 amendment. Do you want to take care of that?
Yes, please.
All right. I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Hollins, please tell us about the A1 amendment.
Yes, so the A1 amendment is just narrowing the scope of the original bill in response to stakeholder feedback.
All right. Great. Any discussion to the A1? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is now in the shape you would like. Representative Hollins, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you, committee members. Good morning. The purpose of House File 2319 is to set clear rules barring two deceptive and manipulative techniques in police interrogations. One is the false evidence ploy, where an officer lies to the suspect about the evidence that police have. And the second is making unauthorized promises of leniency in exchange for a confession. The way this bill works is that if an officer uses one of those methods to obtain a confession, the state will not be able to use that confession in court unless the state can prove that, notwithstanding the use of deception, the statement was voluntary, reliable, and not induced by the deception. The policy underlying this bill is very simple and easily administratable for law enforcement. Officers will know what lines they are not allowed to cross. Through the use of exclusion, the bill provides an appropriately strong incentive to promote compliance. Specifically, the bill excludes a statement when the officer knowingly communicates false facts about the existence or nature of evidence related to the suspected criminal conduct, or communicates unauthorized statements regarding leniency. For example, tells the suspect they will get a deal if they confess when the officer hasn't been authorized by the prosecutor to make a deal like that. There are a number of reasons to support this bill. To me, the most compelling reason is that we tell our children every single day to trust law enforcement, that these are the good guys that you can go to when you're in trouble. But the reality is they are able to lie to you and use deceptive tactics to try to get what it is that they want. There's also another compelling reason, which is it creates false confessions, and there's a number of examples where false confessions have been gotten because of the use of this tactic. So it's just not compelling police practice. It's not the best practices, and in fact, we know that they're sort of steering away from these practices in general, so this bill would just help further move us in the right direction. And I do have testifiers here.
Thank you. I have Andrew Marcourt. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Marcourt. I'm a managing attorney at Great North Innocence Project. We represent individuals who've been wrongfully convicted of crimes and promote public policies to help prevent and remedy wrongful convictions. Now, one of the major contributing factors to wrongful convictions that we look at in our work is false confessions. And I think some people struggle to think, you know, why would people confess to something they didn't do? But we know that it happens. And part of the reason we know it happens is because we have a huge body of DNA exoneration, so cases where we have essentially 100% confidence in the ground truth. And in 30% of those cases, someone confessed, even though we know they didn't do it. So it absolutely happens. Why does it happen? The answers to that are complex. There are many reasons, many of which aren't necessarily easy to regulate. But this bill deals with the low-hanging fruit, the obvious example. And one of the reasons people falsely confess is the use of these deceptive interrogation techniques. The false evidence ploy being the most obvious, where you say, hey, you say you weren't there, but we have your DNA. We have you on camera. Can be really psychologically manipulative and a major driver of false confessions. Now, this issue is not just hypothetical or theoretical. Our client, Terry Olson, spent nearly a decade in prison for a crime he didn't commit, based largely in part on the use of the false evidence ploy. Now, in his case, it was used against an alleged co-conspirator. They said that they had biological evidence in his car that tied him to this murder. That was not true. That was made up. But he confessed in large part as a result of that and implicated our client, Terry, with them. Terry can't be here with us today because of some health issues, but he submitted a letter that I would encourage you all to take a look at. So this bill is meant to prevent wrongful convictions like Terry's, to promote trust in law enforcement, and to promote just good policing for the 21st century. And if you talk to a lot of people in law enforcement and law enforcement training, what they will tell you is this is just a bad tactic. It doesn't work. It's not good at developing information. And that's the reason it's being increasingly abandoned by law enforcement training, including by the federal government. And many departments around the country. I want to note a couple things about the amendment. This was responsive to feedback we received. I specifically want to thank Representative Moeller for her engagement on some of the language in the interim, helped us really improve this bill. You know, there was a concern with the language last year that it was just too broad. There was a concern that we could be sweeping in sort of incidental lies where, you know, perhaps an officer lies while they're trying to build rapport with a suspect. Are we going to throw out a confession that happens 2 hours later because they lied about some personal detail of their life to try and build a human connection? That's not the intent. This language really tightens up that nexus between the substance of the lie and the substance of the case so that it has to be material. It also moves from per se or automatic exclusion to a bit more flexible presumptive exclusion that does allow for consideration of some outlier cases if the state can prove that notwithstanding the use of deceptive tactics, the statement is voluntary, reliable, and not caused by those tactics. So I think it's in many ways a better bill than last year as a result of those changes and is, I think, still hits the target we're trying to hit without shooting too widely and resulting in the exclusion of statements that really should be coming in to evidence. So I hope you'll support the bill and happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Hollins. I do have some concerns on this bill. When custodial interviews are done, well, they are recorded. They are usually set up with a team, with somebody doing the interview, somebody keeping notes, talking, watching. It's not only audio recorded, it's usually video recorded. I've had numerous times in my career where I go to just to talk somebody, doing a custodial interview, and before I can even start, they're admitting to things. Get done with the Miranda warning, they're telling me everything that happened. And in further investigation, which every officer should do, investigate the statement, make sure it's accurate, find out the person wasn't even there, he didn't do it. it happens a lot more than people think. People do give, admit to things that they don't do, not realizing what happened. But there's also times where you have a serious offense, especially dealing with are usually in child custody issues, where a child has been taken sometimes out of state and trying to find them. And sometimes the only way you can do is using some tactics that have been already checked in the court systems, gone through, and they're allowable by the courts, and this would remove those. And it could actually make it harder to find these children that have been taken from the custodial parents. Now, we already have checks and balances in place for these types of questionable interviews that you're talking about. They do not happen very often. But it's a technique that could be very important for the safety of a child or for the getting the information on somebody that actually did a homicide. But a good investigation always goes back and verifies that the statement is true and correct to make sure that the confession is accurate. So, I have problems with this. In the long run, it's a lot more broad than what you're claiming it to be, and it's going to actually make this state less safe. Because these custodial interviews are important. Sometimes just a little bit of information that's received can break that case open and get it more information and more evidence to put that person that actually committed the crime. Our system is set up that we would rather let a guilty man go than an innocent man free. Sure, a guilty man free than incarcerate an innocent man or person. And does it happen occasionally? Yes. It's unfortunate. But our system's designed to be as good as it can be. Is it perfect? We'll never have a perfect system. But taking tools away from law enforcement isn't going to make the state safer. It's not going to make the citizens safer. It's not going to make our children safer. We got to be careful of what tools we take away. We've taken away a lot of tools that officers that are there to protect us and do their damnedest to their job under very difficult circumstances right now.
Representative Johnson, I'll just remind you that this is going to public safety after this.
I understand. So I would, I do not support this bill because I think it's the wrong step to take at this time. Crime is actually very seriously going on. I follow Minneapolis Crime Watch on Twitter, and every day there's shots fired. We need to be able to catch these people, put them behind bars, because most of them are using illegal guns, and they are not, because of the situation, not even supposed to possess them. But yet we do nothing to attack them. Instead, we're going after our law enforcement.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a really important bill. I think that we always have a choice as a society how to balance our constitutional protections and how to ensure that we're also considering public safety. And I think this is important. It's an issue I've been looking into in the context of youth because we know that kids waive their Miranda rights about 90% of the time, so they're particularly vulnerable to these types of tactics. And I would also like to just point out that custodial interrogation is much broader than people who are being interrogated like at a police station while they're being videoed with those protections, which don't always protect them in any case. But it's a very broad set of circumstances where somebody can be questioned, and we want to make sure that these types of deceptive tactics are not being used. Thank you.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins, for your continued work on this bill. I know that there were concerns, and I really appreciate that that's been worked on since last session. Really appreciative as a co-author of this as well that we're getting to a place where this is looking really good. I just, you know, want to touch on a couple things. You know, it was mentioned that not all officers are using these techniques anymore, understanding that we don't want the assumption to be that police are lying to you. We want the assumption between the public and law enforcement to be that we can trust each other and that we can have a candid conversation and that we can find solutions and work together so that folks can get to the resources they need or be held accountable to the level that they should be. So I see this bill as building trust in an area where we really have lost a lot of trust. And that's a true statement, and that's not a knock on anyone. That's just the fact of the circumstances that we're sitting in today. And how do we rebuild that trust between community and public safety? I think this is one of those steps where we're saying, you know, if it remains allowable that someone who's supposed to protect you is able to lie to you, it leaves that space open for people to continue to mistrust law enforcement. And we don't want that. We don't want people to feel that way. So I think by eliminating this possibility that people would go into a room already mistrusting, feeling like they might be lied to, knowing that most officers aren't doing it anyway, this is a great step in building that trust. And I see this as, you know, police community bridge, step in the right direction. And for that reason, I'd like to request a roll call.
Roll call requested. Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair, from Representative Hollins, I do have a question. I guess MPPOA, Sheriff's Association, and Chief's Association had a letter that opposing this bill. Was that changed or where is that letter?
They did not submit it to this committee.
Oh, okay, all right. Did that go to the public safety? I imagine then. All right. I guess I'm kind of curious as to. If you were working with stakeholders and such, who were those stakeholders that work with the County Attorneys Association and the rest of the police associations?
Representative Hollins or Mr. Marcourt, whoever wants to take it. We have like 3.5 minutes, so.
I can answer that. Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Total. And thank you, Representative Grossel. Yes, we've spoken with members of all of the major law enforcement organizations. Including the ones you mentioned, and the County Attorneys Association, which I understand has not taken a position on this bill as of now. I'm familiar with the letter. I think it addresses one small sliver of the concerns that we have in talking about voluntariness. We're light slowed on time, but this bill is interested in voluntariness. It's also interested in the reliability of statements, which goes beyond the constitutional standard. It's interested in some of the concerns people have been talking about. Police integrity, it's interested in good tactics. So I just think that the what they're talking about only addresses a part of what we're trying to accomplish.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
have, I
want not
to make
having
sure that Representative Scott has time for the last word. So
yes, Madam Chair. Having said what you did as far as all those stakeholders having concerns, it's not done. I mean, you should have kept working on this, should have kept going and to fine-tune it to make it something that is palatable for all the stakeholders if you want to bring a good bill forward. To me, I look at this and these practices are ancient and long past. To me, it's hard to sit here and listen to legislation come forward year after year here, undermining and diminishing the law enforcement community and trying to make them out as the people that lie, as the people that are horribly abusive and all this other garbage that keeps coming forward. And it's to me, this is just a poke in the eye to our law enforcement community, alleging that they're willfully deceptive. I mean, it's for no good reason. It is upheld under the Supreme Court that some deceptive techniques are acceptable. So I guess I just have one question to ask. If I were to have two suspects and I'm sitting in a room with one and a partner's in the room with the other, interviewing them, interrogating them, and I tell them, your partner's come clean already. So, I mean, it behooves you to get on the same sheet of music with them. Is that something that we wouldn't be able to do anymore, or law enforcement wouldn't be able to do?
Mr. Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Grossel. I think the devil's a little bit in the details, so it has to be a knowingly false statement about the existence or nature of evidence. So if the officer knows that that's a lie, then you would trip this up. I will tell you that officers are quite sophisticated and know how to do this in a way that even under existing law tends to avoid those lines. So, you know, you can say, look, your buddy's in the other room, and he's, you know, he's going to rat on you. He's going to, and then, you know, you're going to be in a tough position. Like, there are ways to do that don't cross these lines, and actually officers are pretty good at knowing where those lines are, and I think they would be able to handle those situations quite skillfully.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Mueller. Yeah, we're moving on. You used up. We got to get out of here, and I want to make sure that everyone has a chance to speak. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to thank the Innocence Project and Representative Hollins for your work on this bill, and there really has been a lot of stakeholder engagement, including with the amendment that was brought forward today. So really appreciate that. I just want to say that custodial interviews are important, and this doesn't end custodial interviews. It doesn't take away tools that are in the toolbox. It is not going after law enforcement. This is really going after training that was given to law enforcement in the past, the Reed technique. And they've moved away from that technique for good reason, because innocent people were confessing. In your handout, you talked about new training. That's the model training that moves away from these practices. So really, this is going at old, outdated training that makes innocent people confess. We all want guilty people to confess to a crime. We don't want innocent people to confess to a crime. And so I really appreciate your work on this bill. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Scott.
I'll try to talk fast, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
You know, it's been said that and characterized by the bill's author that law enforcement's not trustworthy. And Representative Curran, trust is a two-way street. We've got law enforcement officers out there, and, hey, I've gone against my own caucus on some things, like body cameras and license plate readers and all those things. So I just want to say that what we're doing, especially it seems like in Minnesota, is we're attacking law enforcement. And again, this is a two-way street, trust is. And law enforcement out there, they're trying to put away the bad guys. And they turn around and these people are back out on the street recommitting crimes. And that's not what's good for the community. But the rhetoric from the other side that is anti-law enforcement, you know, this bill was pulled. It was scheduled the week of our officers and our firefighter being murdered. And there was a reason for that, because you knew it was too sensitive.
Representative
data.
Scott, that is not true. Representative Hollins was ill. That is why we rescheduled the bill.
Madam,
you don't get to make up reasons why I did things in this committee. Please wrap up, Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, the fact remains that the other side enjoys attacking law enforcement.
Representative Scott,
vote no.
You know that was out of line.
The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Minority Lead Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll excused. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Yes.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
7 ayes, 5 nays, 1 excused.
With 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. House Bill 2319, as amended, is referred to the Public Safety Committee. Thank you, Representative Holland. Sorry you did not get a closing, but we...
I have so much to say.
I know. Well, it's going to public safety. So thank you all. With that, we are adjourned.